Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Soul Rift podcast. I'm Simon Ledgate, the master of all things Soul Rift. And for this special first episode, I'm joined by Scott Hartzman, executive producer for Rift at Trion Worlds. We're speaking about, of course, Rift.
Look at that Rift. Ascend! We're fighting invasions with a puppy.
Rift is an MMORPG. It's pretty awesome. You can read my full review about Rift and get a free trial to play Rift for yourself at www.soulrift.com. And without further ado...
Ascend! I'm on a horse, and it's on fire.
So, are you still executive producer of Rift, or have they changed your title in the last 6 months?
Well, my official title has actually always been Chief Creative Officer of Trion. But the job that I do day-to-day for 94.9% of my day is being the exec producer of Rift. So that's just it seems to make a bit more sense to explain to people what I actually do with a title. So yep, I am still being that guy.
Now, random offshoot question.
Yeah.
You say like 94% is I know Trion's working on at least one other game that they announced.
We've talked about two already.
So do you do much with that, or do you mostly do Rift?
I do mostly Rift. Other than that, the Defiance guys down in San Diego are the game that I spend the least amount of time on. The majority of my shared time is either Trion corporate stuff or and little bits of End of Nations and figuring out how we can take the things that we learned in launching Rift and helping those guys get their game out the door. You know, things like patching, security, launching, running betas, you know, how we did rollouts, you know, just making sure that we have really that we're just taking advantage of all the stuff we learned in the smartest way that we can.
Mm-hmm. So mostly Rift, and that's sort of mostly what I'm interested in.
Cool.
So last time we spoke, I think it was between beta 4 and 5, just prior to the launch.
Uh-huh.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the launch? I know it's kind of looking back a long time, and people have probably said a lot, but in hindsight, would you say, you know, it went as well as you had expected with all the preparation you had done with the betas?
In hindsight, it went even better than we had expected. The overall launch stability, we were very happy with. The crowds that we got into the game they far exceeded anything we had hoped for. Yet we still had, you know, plans in place to get new hardware online if we needed it. And it turns out that we did need to bring quite a bit of it online. And the places that we got surprised, I would say, were the speed at which we started having to deal with security issues and the speed at which, you know, farmers, hackers, and so on, descended on the game as soon as Head Start began, really. That was the biggest thing for all of us. We ended up getting through all of it and having to come up with some pretty creative solutions for some of the problems. We came out with CoinLock to prevent people from losing all their stuff. Put the gas pedal down on the way that we started handling bots and botters and spam and spammers to where, you know, yes, they still exist, but they're usually gone fairly rapidly. And so now they're just a part of how we run our games.
So I remember my particular launch experience was sitting in like 2,000 person queues to try to get into my favorite server.
Yeah.
So when you say the launch went really well, I just remember, I just want to log in. And
yes,
of course, as soon as you get disconnected,
right,
you're back in queue for 6 hours.
Yeah. And so that was, we had backup plans to bring more hardware online and, you know, to get more hardware in-house in general. You know, we did get all of that there. We beefed up the hardware, you know, we beefed up basically all of the, it was every production server that we have. And, you know, that was part of that staged rollout of how to let people move around more freely, which also, you know, begat free character transfer. And so that was all part of the same population issues we were dealing with, which was how do we handle this, you know, game that's a larger success than we had hoped for and let people also get some social freedom at the same time. And so far, we're actually calling that one pretty much a big win still.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned three big features that kind of came in very shortly.
Yeah.
Well, transfer is not so much shortly, but definitely the coin lock and the spam filters.
Yep.
As someone who was there in those queues and occasionally in the game when the queues ran out, the spam filter and the coin lock were definitely interesting. I mean, very pertinent features that as a player you kind of saw.
Sure.
You know, come into the game. On the coin lock, I mean, as a regular player, I didn't see very much hacking and botting. I mean, right. I played a lot of MMOs. I'm used to seeing bots all over the place, and I didn't really see it with Rift. So I guess you guys were really on the ball with catching them out.
Yeah, I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is that we've hit a steady state of banning about 5,000 bot spam and fraud accounts every week.
Oh wow!
It's a fairly large scale problem, and it continues to be a large scale problem because usually the pattern is harmful all the way from start to finish, because you end up with people buying accounts. Either they steal, they hack an account and they steal it, or they buy an account on a stolen credit card and then they use that account for botting or spamming, which also annoys people. Yeah, so we had to, we had to dive in there and really take care of them because it's harmful to everybody. A lot of people think MMO companies, oh, well, they're just being lazy about this, or they're just not dealing with it because they happen to see a botter, for 2 or 3 days straight. But what a lot of people don't realize is those botters are in on stolen credit cards most of the time anyway. And when that happens and those credit card charges ended up getting charged back, the MMO companies pay fines for that. It's in every MMO company's financial best interest to get those people the hell out of there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the quotes you gave when we last spoke was, I would dare you to ask any exec at a gaming company how much they've had to pay in MasterCard and Visa fines because of fraud. So
exactly.
I'm asking you, I'll take your dare and I'll ask you how much you've had to pay in MasterCard and Visa fines.
Yeah, and I don't have the specific number off the top of my head, but I can guarantee you it's a number that I would very much have rather been able to put back into the development of the game instead of just paying it as a fine. It's a meaningful enough number to where, numbers like the scale we're talking about can actually make a difference in getting features done, creating jobs, hiring people, and just providing a better service. And, we've got everything under control now to where, we have both human beings and systems in place whose job it is to be on the lookout for fraudulent charges the instant they happen, or within, either we've got two kinds of checks, right? We've got the instant it happens where things just get denied. But then we also have human beings eyeballing stuff, doing pattern recognition to preemptively get rid of people even before they have a chance to stir up trouble. And even with that, some people still get through, at which point the hacker detection, botter detection, and spam detection all kicks in. And then we get rid of those people in batches as well. So yeah, it's really like it's like a three-stage effort.
Now you talked about how you had set it up with gigs and gigs of econ data logging.
Yeah.
Has that panned out? Have you any interesting stories of things that you've caught with that?
Let me think.
I remember at one point runecrafting got disabled and
that was like early beta where basically runecrafting turned into just a money creation engine as fast as you could right click. Fortunately that did happen in alpha and not live. Ever since we've been live, because we have the ability to detect very weird conditions like, hey, 10,000 plat just appeared out of thin air.
Not a good sign
on a guy, and so it's very easy for us to look at what happened and then disable whatever occurred, whether it's an ability, a recipe, a creature, an item, or basically any noun that you can think of in the game, we can turn on and off in real time. So that's helped a lot. If we discovered, for instance, that the auction system, somebody discovered a corner condition in that, we can turn on and off the auction system globally by shard, however, all without even logging into the game. So, having very robust remote administration tools has preempted a lot of the kinds of economic disasters, you would have seen in games, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago.
And would you say, by and large, do you think the coin lock feature has been as successful as you might have hoped? Has it dissuaded hackers from trying to take over accounts? Or do people
it hasn't dissuaded anybody from trying. It's definitely cut down. It's had a noticeable reduction because of one thing. If you use, let's say somebody has your password because you made the mistake of using the same password on an insecure forum site a million years ago, and they have that compromised database. So if that hacker comes to the Tryon site and starts trying to log you in, they'll get coin locked. If you also used that password on your email account, well, then they can uncoin lock you and do whatever they want.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, in the cases of people who reuse passwords across everything, CoinLock really doesn't help them so much because if their email is generally compromised too. You know, one of the types of attacks that we saw very rapidly was the hackers have lists of email addresses and passwords from many hacked sites all across the internet. And really, as soon as we went into Head Start, we started seeing them trying to brute force these databases mm-hmm. of tens of millions of account credentials. You know, then when they get one of those, fantastic. Then they can also try that against the email address. And if they can log you in, well, then guess what? They just got all your stuff.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the weird questions I have. I was surprised a bit when Blizzard did this with World of Warcraft. Used to have, you know, have a login name and a password, yeah. and they changed your login name into your email address.
Yeah.
And Rift also does that. Mm-hmm. Your login name is your email address, which is presumably the same email address that they send your
right.
CoinLock password to. Isn't that, you know, wouldn't it be an extra layer of security if you had a login name separate from the email address and the
yeah.
email address was hidden or obfuscated in some way that if someone gets your login and password, yep. they can't get your email address, so they can't figure out what to try your password on, you know?
Right, undoubtedly. That is absolutely the case. And speaking as a guy who was kind of like the, you know, a third-party observer on both sides of the discussion, I can completely understand both sides. On the one side, you have, hey, protect your username. It's effectively half of your password, you know, right? That's what we were telling yep. users 10 years ago. But at the meanwhile, the vast majority of sites on the internet have kind of standardized on you not needing to invent a fictional name for yourself. And that, for better or worse, has kind of become the de facto internet standard. When you're trying to make a service that is accessible to a lot of people, you know, if you really want to go, you know, an example from the old days, think about trying to make an AOL screen name, you know, back, say, what, 15 years ago, where, you know, you'd type your name in and it would give you, oh, I'm sorry, you can't use that name. Here, try this other list of random 97 names that don't make any sense to you.
Same thing with Skype.
Right, exactly. Back in the days when pseudonyms were more common and everybody who was on the internet had their own personal alias, it worked out well. But these days, that's becoming less and less the case.
Right.
And so it's, you know, again, like I said, I can see both sides of it. One of the things we have discussed is allowing people to set a custom login name on top of their email address such that they could set their account to only log in with that pseudonym. But that has not been a huge priority for us in the time since launch. I mean, the number of actual successful hacks, you know, on a given day is down in the two digits, you know, where...
That's pretty good then.
Well, yeah, where back in the pre-CoinLock days, it was in the four digits. And
now, what about the authenticator? I know you guys
right.
offered out a free...
Yep.
I think it's a free authenticator you can download onto like a cell phone or something.
Yep. Yeah, and people who are using the either the iPhone or the Android app end up effectively completely safe. We've never seen a hacked account that was actually using one of our authenticators.
Can you give any kind of figure on the uptake? Like, is it very few people, a lot of people, half the people?
Oh, geez. It's more. I don't know the absolute number, unfortunately. The last time I was paying attention to numbers on that, it was a minority, but mm-hmm. not a tiny minority. So we're talking...
significant minority.
Yeah, exactly. So somewhere, you know, whether it's like the 15 to 25% range,
that's
I forget.
Pretty good.
But yeah, you know,
even
if it was 10% range, that would still, you know, be worthwhile as far as we're concerned. Because, you know, well, actually, hell, I'll be totally honest. Even if it was in the 1% range, I would still call it worthwhile because when somebody does get hacked, we have the ability to then point them at this other tool they can use.
Yeah.
And now they're fine. And so just for having it around as that extra bit of safety, I think definitely adds value in the, you know, regardless.
So going on from what you've added to security to, mm-hmm. you mentioned also the server transfers, and this was something that sort mm-hmm. of, there was a lot of talk about it at the time,
yeah.
because I think the server transfers came in about, what, 3-4 months after launch?
Right about there, yeah.
And I think that's around the time then populations were shifting,
yes.
say that diplomatically, from certain servers. And there were some servers where there was complaints of too few people, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so the server transfers, and then that sort of helped rebalance things, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, what there was a step that preceded that actually, which was we had intentionally beefed up all of the hardware such that people would be able to get themselves onto bigger servers in the first place. What we effectively did was we raised the caps on all of the servers and then made sure that people had the ability to go there if they so chose. And obviously a large number of them chose to, and that was fine because of the, you know, the way our back end is architected. It, you know, it became, I'm not going to say trivial, but it did become reasonable amounts of work for us to facilitate that.
Now, I know for some games, the whole server transfer thing is a bit of a nightmare because of how they design the game, not thinking about transfers. I guess when you built Rift, you had transfers at least somewhere in your mind, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we knew for a fact that we would want to get that service online at some point. It just became a matter of when and how. And then when we, you know, when we had our launch population burst, we knew we were going to need to let people, rebalance as they chose to stick around with their friends. Yeah.
So as of right now, players can do server transfers for free still, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I know with a lot of games, they've used server transfers as a way of sort of generating a bit of income. They charge $10 or whatever for a server transfer. Was that ever a challenging decision on your part? Like, you know, we think of all the money we could have made by charging for server transfers.
Honestly, no. I mean, you know, because I still get a report every hour that shows who's transferring where, and the number is ridiculously high of people who have used the service. And we don't necessarily look at those as people who have, an extra $10 that we could have made. That's kind of like the same piracy argument, right? Because if three guys download your game, that doesn't mean they were going to go buy it in the first place. similar thing, right? If three people transfer, that doesn't mean they would have transferred if there was a fee. And so, so to us, we look at it more as by letting you play with your friends, chances are you're happier and chances are you are being retained as a customer longer, which is what we'd rather do. We'd rather have happy customers longer. Now, that said, I still think that there are some services out there that you absolutely should charge a fee for, but it's not about making money. It's about a cost barrier. Meaning, like, let me give you an example of a service we don't offer right now. The ability to take a character and put it on a different account. If and when we offered that, we would probably have to put a barrier fee on it, if only to, for the security and the fraud and the rest, you know, such that it didn't get abused in a way to where people end up, it's a transaction like that becomes inherently not unwindable the way a hack is. If a hack happens, as long as everything's on the same account and approximately in the same place, we can restore it in 3 seconds because we have, you know, backups online and the rest of it. The more we let people move stuff between accounts and across, you know, and across other things, it becomes a lot harder to unwind in cases of problems. So there'd probably have to be a modest barrier fee. But it would be just enough to make people pause, not to create a new profit center. I mean, we're looking, our profit center, as far as we're concerned, is happy customers saying subscribe for as long as they, you know, as long as they can.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And on the topic of making customers happy, there have been a lot of other systems that have been introduced to the game. One of them that we talked about extensively was the auto everythinger, auto grouper system. that wasn't there at launch, but did come in. And I have to say, I was really impressed. There's a few changes I'd make, but when you went around making the auto everythinger system for Rift, how you set up the party so it had to have, you know, a healer and a support, and I guess you had a difficult challenge, which was to analyze someone's soul build and figure out what role they actually filled.
Yep.
So can you tell us a bit about making that system?
Oh, yeah. Well, I can tell you secondhand, because I did hear programmers swearing, one in particular.
Poor guy.
Yeah, I mean, so trying to do an auto group maker when you have characters who have the capacity of playing multiple things but may not actually have or choose to play that combat role is definitely an extra layer more challenging. It's actually 2 layers more challenging than a standard system or, you know, than a system that has gone before. So yeah, we did have some unique challenges to solve there, especially with adding a role called support, which is something that people have seemed to enjoy having around a lot. You know, where we're actually calling that out as a separate type of thing you can do in a game. So yeah, I mean, rolling it out was, you know, something we had been looking forward to for quite some time. You know, if you want to talk about, you know, where did it go right and where do we think we can do better, I think it definitely went right in the dungeons, for sure. It gets used for that constantly. It does still get used for quests as well. But obviously dungeons and cross war group dungeons are the, you know, the biggest use. I believe usage of our dungeons went up by a factor of 5 or something obscene after we had done that.
It was tough to get into the dungeons.
Right. Yeah. That. I mean, nobody wants to scream and shout. People just want the system to make their group for them so they can get on with the fun, and that's cool. One of the places that we think it has not been the great answer was the, you know, I would like to get into an open world Rift group or, you know, open world dynamic content group and just go. You know, I think we all agree that that tab really hasn't scratched the itch it was supposed to, which is actually one of the subjects that kind of got brought up the last producer's letter I did, like, you know, I think it was 7 weeks ago now. You know, we've talked about other ways to get people out into open world action, where we've got a system called Instant Adventure in the works right now. And so that system, you know, where the game will be building up groups for you and having people join those groups as they are doing larger and larger content across the countryside, we're hoping that that system scratches that itch.
Yeah, actually, the dynamic content is one of the big issues I wanted to discuss with you, because the whole Rifts and Invasion thing was really one of my strong draws to Rift, because in World of Warcraft, you know, and other MMOs, I sort of, you level up to the maximum level, and then you do some dungeons, but then there's not much else to do.
Right.
If you don't feel like doing a dungeon, there's nothing left to do.
You got it.
Especially there's no solo content. Mm-hmm. There's nothing you can just walk off and do the way you could just walk off and quest.
Right.
And so with the Rifts and Invasions, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. You know, anytime I'm bored, I can just walk off and start doing some Rifts and Invasions.
Right.
I don't know. It just hasn't seemed to work out for me.
Right.
The way I was kind of hoping. And I was trying to think of why. And one of the reasons I remember during beta and when I was leveling up, I kept sending in feedback saying, this is really annoying because I'm trying to turn in a quest and this invasion has taken over the quest camp and killed all the NPCs.
Right.
And so I think they tweaked it a little bit to make that not so much of an issue, although it still happens. But then once you're level 50, you're not questing. You're like, oh, well, why bother doing any of these invasions?
Right.
They're not actually taking over anything. And it's this sort of dichotomy where you're trying to mix two kinds of content. You've got this sort of dynamic content and this static doing quest content.
Yep.
It's hard to fit those into the same zones.
It absolutely is. I can wholeheartedly agree with that. I think one of the other places that we could have done better, and we actually are, you know, going through steps to do better here right now, is what's the incentive for continuing to go off and do these larger scale events and larger scale invasions? Most people don't know this, but for instance, every time we do a new world event, that world event comes with its own custom large scale, you know, epic scale zone event that is, you know, is telling part of the story for the larger world flow. But most people don't really know that because there's not a very strong incentive to continue doing events like that. And very bluntly, they're way more fun the more people show up.
Yes.
And so we are, you know, one of the things we're
to an extent. I mean, when you've got 500
right,
players,
right, right.
A monster doesn't load in on your screen.
Sorry, up to a point of sanity. Yeah. But yeah, so one of the things that we're actively doing, you know, I believe it got checked in over the last couple of weeks and it'll go out with 1.5, is creating entire new incentives for people to go off and continue to do these things because they're a lot of fun and people want them to be fun and people want to do them, but they just want to feel like they're being rewarded for their time. And rewarded for their effort, bluntly.
Exactly. And I mean, I guess to a certain extent, a lot of the time when I talk to friends who say, oh, I don't care about these because all you get is planner 8.
Right, exactly. You know, yeah, I mean, so we know for a fact that the excitement and the reward was definitely, you know, the gameplay was fun, but the reward needs to be there in order for people to do it. Otherwise, they're just going to do activities that reward more.
Yeah.
And so there's two ways we're looking to address that. One is with better loot, more appropriate rewards from this, as well as they'll continue to be a great source of post-50 experience gain for the planar advancement system that's coming out in 1.5 also. They should, if it all works out, be a place where you want to go because you want new toys as well as you want the XP for doing them.
And before we get to planner advancement, though, there's a few other things on the dynamic content front. Two other sort of feedback question issues.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I've noticed, especially when there's fewer people participating in the event, is that it when you look at the map, I mean, you added in a recent patch or a month or two ago, a little blue shield icon so you can actually see what you're supposed to be doing. And there's arrows that show you, you know, where the different groups of monsters are going, but there's no feedback for where the other players are participating in the event. So unless you're actually part of a raid group that you've joined, either with the join public group or the LFG system, you're not really sure where you have to go to defend a location. So you might see a location that's under attack, you run there, but there's already players there.
True.
You might think, oh yeah, someone else will take care of it, and then it falls and you lose the event.
Yeah.
So have you thought of trying to incorporate in some way active player participation indicators?
Yeah, we definitely have, but I think the core thing we wanted to solve first is the rewardability in general to create more of the demand for that type of activity in the first place. And then once we have that nailed down better than we do right now, then absolutely. The thing you just pointed out is it has bugged me myself on any number of occasions. So yeah, but I think the core rewardability is the bigger thing to tackle first.
Another thing that kind of bugged me was that the dynamic content, once you started doing a lot of it, actually feels quite static because all of the stuff is prescripted. Like when you go to a rift, there's 5 or 6 stages or whatever, but all those stages are prescripted. There's no sense of randomness or dynamic content within the dynamic content itself.
Right.
So although the rift might open up in a random location, once you go there, you're like, oh, it's this rift. I know exactly what all 5 waves are going to be. And it just feels a little bit disappointing when it's like, oh, I've got to kill the same set of monsters over and over again. Have you thought of randomizing the rifts themselves? Or the invasion?
So actually, we originally had the system working that way. And while it might sound like it's more fun on the surface, it's actually kind of not, because it turns out computers are very poor at assembling entertainment for people. I know this, I'm sure this will shock you, but that's more why we refer to an individual rift or an individual invasion more as a building block and less as the end-all be-all. The larger scale event, whether it's a zone event with a single colossus or an epic event with 5 different stages of stuff to play through, as really what dynamic content needs to be all about. Because yeah, I mean, there's a rift is interesting to a point. What makes the content itself interesting is how those building blocks come together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like the when I apologize for the terrible, terrible analogy, but if you were to pull one Lego out of a bag and hand it to me and go, this one Lego isn't terribly interesting, I would agree with you and say, right, but that's not its job. You know, the job is how can you assemble all of these things together to make stuff that's really cool.
And the one last suggestion or question I had about the dynamic content was, if there's difficulty incorporating dynamic content and static content, i.e. having the stuff take place in the same zones. I mean, obviously with PvP, the solution is to create separate PvP war fronts. Mm-hmm. The idea of having a separate zone for the dynamic content, something like several locations, almost like a PvP war front, but between players and monsters. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would be a possible way of expanding the dynamic content in Rift?
I refuse to grant specifics on this, but I hope you look forward to update 1.6.
1.6.
That's all I'm really saying. But yes, suffice it to say, yeah, we that is a sentiment that a lot of us here would agree with too. I don't think it's as cut and dried as either or, but I definitely agree that there is value in creating specific destinations for specific gameplay types such that people have a known place they could go to gather to take part.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's been one of the things we've been working on for, geez, I would say 4 or 5 months now.
Now, 1.6, when is that due out?
Does not have a, given that we're not even at 1.5 yet, 1.6 doesn't really have a date.
1.4 now.
Yeah.
1.5 is the fire one, right?
Yes.
Fire.
Yep.
Yeah, because each update seems to be focused on one of the 6 elemental.
Yep.
Updates. And actually, that's one of the big questions I had, is that the update frequency for Rift is astounding. It's every month or 2 months.
It's crazy,
per update. And each update has whole new raid zones, I think. Each update has at least one new raid zone.
Mm-hmm.
How on earth have you managed to do that? I think it's kind of funny, because there was a story recently where Electronic Arts was saying, oh yeah, with Star Wars The Old Republic, we're going to make sure to have lots of content, you know, keeping with the industry standard of 18 to 24 months. And I'm like, you can't do 18 to 24 months when Rift is doing it every 1 or 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Any insight into how you've managed to keep that pace?
We are, you know, it's been an...
Is that much of a slave driver?
No. I mean, honestly, that's really not it at all. I mean, we have people busting their asses, and yes, we have people working a lot, but it's not like we are definitely not in hard crunch. We really haven't been. We've got what I would call a reasonably healthy flow of work. And a lot of it came down to, a lot of it was conscious decisions around how did we choose to structure our production and structure our shipping. And, you know, everything from the way we build to the way we QA to the way we update to the way we test to the way we release to the way we iterate has all been beginning, I would say, about 2 years before the game shipped even, we started getting into these patterns that we could repeat and iterate rapidly. And that's really what I think we owe a lot of the success to, is a group decision to create everything such that we could create AAA game and iterate at the speed of what people would normally expect out of web things as opposed to games. Because games don't iterate this rapidly as a rule, but again, that was part of the core mission since, you know, at least the day I got here, and I imagine long before, which is, what is a game that is built from the ground up to operate in the almost real-time web, to how does a game like that get built and maintained and shipped and so on? And so, yeah, you know, everything about our systems, from the fact that there's a full copy of the world running on every staff member's desktop machine so they can iterate on their own work 20 times a day or 100 times a day, there's a huge power in that. If you compare that to the kinds of MMOs we were making, say, 10 years ago, designers, in order for them to, you know, in order to iterate their work, they would check it in and then have to wait for the update to the test server with its actual users, which might not happen for 4 days. So you're able to get a lot more done. The same cycle that we used to pull off in 4 days, people now pull off in 4 minutes.
Just upload it and test it and upload it and test it.
Yeah, there's not even uploading, literally. It's, you know, it's servers reading off of their desktops. It's being able to change data and having the servers reloaded in real time, and so on and so on. You know, we can even do that with our actual public test shard, where, you know, they can tweak some data while they've got a group of raiders in there, and then, oh, okay, time to make some balance changes, push a button. Okay, good, the new NPC values are here, let's try the raid again. You know, it's so really, it all comes down to speed of iteration. I think that this is the thing we took as a given. The amount of quality that you get to is going to be directly proportional to the number of times you can iterate. So given that, let's treat that as a fact, and say, okay, if that is a fact, then what's the thing that you need to optimize for? How fast can I iterate? Because that is that's the key. And it's been very very embedded into everything that we do, whether it's having multiple people whose full-time jobs are working on tools for the team to work faster. A lot of companies, tools development is, you know, the thing that gets shunted off to the programmer who ends up hating his job.
Poor guy.
You're right. In our case here, we had at least 3 full-time people doing nothing but tools so people could do their jobs better and make content faster and make content better. And, you know, whether that content be art or gameplay content or what have you. So, you know, again, it's just kind of burned into the culture here, really.
With all that rapid content, I mean, there are a number of things to look forward to in the future. You started to mention something about the Planner Advancement System.
And by the way, it is actually called Planner Attunement.
Well, the Planner Attunement System, can you share any secret details?
I
mean, not secrets, but
details? I don't know how secret it will be, because it's actually been playable on our public test chart for, I'd say, about a week now. And yeah, here's the idea behind the system. This is not a system where you look at it and go, okay, I'm going to grind all the way from start to finish. You can totally do that if you want, but the philosophy behind it is, as you continue to play the game, for all of the stuff you do, whether it's Warfronts or dungeons or PvP rifts or dynamic content, if you're level 50, you should really continue to get XP for that, right? I mean, you're putting forth effort. You should get rewarded in XP, and you should have something to do with that XP that is fun but is not going to completely imbalance the game or turn it into a grind that is required to progress. And so I think there's a balance that we're trying to strike between how much reward feels like it was worth the time without crossing over into the lands of making the game unapproachable. because the game still does need to be, including the end game, still needs to be approachable to people who will sign up to the game this year. So yeah, it's a system based on the planes of the game. As you turn level 50, you will be introduced to the experience of being level 50 by one of our new chronicles. It's called the Chronicles of Attunement. This is your level 50 into post-game graduation ceremony. It takes place in one of the chronicles. If you're a guardian, obviously it happens in Sanctum. If you're a defiant, it happens in Meridian. And you go through and you become more deeply attuned to the planes, which unlocks the ability for you to now spend points in which planes do you wish to become more attuned to. It is an open-ended system in the sense that you can continue earning and you can continue spending in all of them. Like I said, it's more of an open-ended exploratory system than it is about having to always optimize your specific choices. It's a open-ended post-50 advancement, and we're tying it in pretty well, I think, via the new Chronicles also.
Nice. Now, of course, one of the things that every MMO player looks forward to is an increase to the level cap or the addition of new classes.
Yeah.
Do you think I assume at some point we will probably see something like that in Rift, but do you have any kind of time frame or what you feel like? Is the game ready for that sort of thing yet?
At some point you probably will. I've had the most luck in the past when you tie those types of things to expansions and entire new areas, you know, entire new continents or planes or what have you to explore. And so the current thinking is if and when we do that, it would be best to tie it to a very large scale expansion. Mm-hmm. And I will, you know, I'm sure it won't come as a gigantic surprise if I let you know that, yes, we have in fact had people working on an expansion. You know, obviously any game that pulls in a sufficient audience clearly is going to be able to go forward and continue to expand the world even beyond their live plans. And, you know, we are absolutely doing that. But yeah, as for specific timelines or themes or anything or what would be contained remains to be seen.
Now, there is one sort of folk theory going around because each major content update so far has been, you know, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3. And the theory is that 2.0 is going to be that big expansion. I guess, do you want to confirm or deny?
comment. It would probably be called 2.0, but remember, we can always go 1.9, 1.10, 1.11. We don't need to be mathematically accurate in the way we label our updates.
So we might go to like 1.99 before we see 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, remember, we always, the reason that our major updates are 1.0, 1.1, 1.2, and our minors are like 1.2.1. So we think of them more as not necessarily mathematically accurate in terms of, you know, decimal precision, and more in terms of global major minor type of scheme.
I had a few other community requests. One question that a lot of people asked me to ask you was about a system where you could either reshuffle or change the loot you get. For example, if you're in a dungeon, a group of five, and you've got, I don't know, four mages and a rogue, mm-hmm. which I've occasionally done, which is a lot of fun. You won't see that in any other game. Rogue tank, mage healing, and three DPS. Yep. It's great.
Yep.
But as soon as you enter the dungeon knows that you've got a rogue and four mages. And every time you kill a boss, the game knows you've got a rogue and four mages, and then it drops some chain or some plate.
And the game is full of spite, I believe, is what you're asking me.
Exactly.
The game full of spite? It is not doing that on purpose. And yeah, that is actually one of the... So yes, that was something we had thought of ahead of time in our system. But truthfully, that was something that we also figured would be mitigated at least somewhat by the fact that in at least our, you know, 50 and up dungeons, you have this extra currency where you're always guaranteed to be getting something that you're working toward. And we have that in a lot of our systems, whether that's dynamic content and the planar currency, where you can spend to get cool items that are appropriate. In dungeons, you have dungeon currencies and reputations that you can spend to get cool items. Even in raids, yes, there's drops, but there's also these currencies that you can totally get to get appropriate items. You know, I'm not philosophically opposed to any kind of smart loot system, for sure. And I think that there's definitely some places where it could be a very good idea for us to do that. But right now, one of the things we're focusing on more for 1.5 or one of the minor updates after that is more making sure that our token loot is actually making sense and is a fun upgrade path. One of the things that we just did in the last update was with our PvP loot and our, you know, our PvP favor gear and the rank gear, and we made a much more fun progression path between rank 1 and rank 6 where things took less currency to get your next upgrade, and we essentially changed the way the system worked to where it always became the smart idea to where if you could get an upgrade, you should go buy it.
I think you changed it so you actually upgrade the item you have instead of replace.
Right, and then we lowered the cost to compensate for that so nobody actually lost any ground. And the combination of the two was pretty spectacular. And so I think that's an analogy that we're looking to apply to the dungeon gear right now too, for instance. Games are way more fun when you're not sitting on a pile of currency going, man, I really want a new cool thing, but I know the smart decision is to wait another 3 weeks to go spend it. You know, and that's not fun. And so, you know, the PvP test was a great test for this, and now we're going to end up doing the same to PvE. Getting back onto smart loot for a second, though, I do think that smart loot does have a couple of specific uses where it would be very, very smart to do this. And, you know, one of the things I think is possibly relic weapons that the raiders are seeing at the end where, you know, we have a lot of different types of loot in our game. Because, you know, like you had just said, you know, you got a rogue tank and, you know, your mage is healing and your mage is DPSing. Mages don't have this issue so much, but we all know rogues and cleric need a couple of sets of gear and warriors do too. So, you know, being able to unclog. But being able to unclog some of that loot, I think would help. And so I think that there's some tactical places where we should be looking into that in future updates.
Yeah, because one of the funny things that our guild experienced when we were doing Gilded Prophecy.
Yeah.
The first 5 weeks we did it, every boss dropped only cleric loot. And it just became this running joke because we only had one cleric that would run with us. And he got, well, first of all, he got everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Duplicates and triplicates of everything. And we're like, we want to see some different gear.
Right. You know, I think a system that is globally that way is a little bit of overkill, I definitely think there's good use for smart application of it. Because, yeah, I mean, what's the fun in going when all of the rewards roll totally against you?
Now, one of the ideas we had debated, we were sitting in our guilds thinking, how are we going to fix this problem if we were working at Tryon? And one of the ideas that came up was the idea of voting on what loot drops so that everyone can look at the loot table, everyone gets to pick which thing they want to see, and then one of those gets dropped. So at least it's the case that the thing that drops isn't something that no one wants to see.
Sure, sure. I don't know. I think you might be asking for... So as a mental exercise, I actually really love that and think it's awesome. But I think at the end of the day, I would rather create a system where you're going to hate me instead of hating each other. Seriously. Because think about it. I mean, if you've got 10 people in an instance and you're all voting and you're all whatever, some guy clicks a thing and that guy suddenly gets what he wants. Now there's a chance that other people in the guild are going to hate him. I'd really rather have them hating me because we're devs. We're built for that. You know, it's part of the job description. Yeah, so I would much rather be the target of ire instead of you taking it.
Another target of ire amongst my friends who like to raid is, in a lot of the fights, there's a lot of stuff going on, which is a lot of fun, but it makes it very difficult to compensate for a slow loading time or a little bit of lag. And one of the times that really hits us is when we battle res someone. Because when you get battle res, it's like the game has to reload the whole zone, and so you don't see anything for a while.
Yep.
You thought of ever adding like a 1 or 2 second invulnerability after getting a battle res, so you don't, you know, res right into a thing of fire, and then you can't walk out of it before you're dead.
That's actually not a bad idea at all. Getting that
you
issue
think that would be exploited.
Yeah, I mean anything, right? Anything we do, we have to worry about it being exploited. But just the general idea of making that process faster. I know that's on our list. I guarantee you that is on a bug list. I just saw it again this Monday. So, that is a problem we know and would like to solve.
One of the things I love about MMOs is data and statistics.
Yeah.
I was talking to Chris, the PR guy, about the types of things we talk about. Mm-hmm. And I had mentioned, is there any chance of pulling up some cool statistics and facts about Rift?
Mm-hmm.
To give an example, with Final Fantasy XI, every year they would do this census where they would publish, you know, how many players are for each race and gender, yeah. how many players for each class. Have you ever thought of doing a Rift census where you'd say, you know, how many Defiant and Guardians, how many?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we actually did a big infographic a couple of months after launch. We should probably do another one of those. That last one was kind of fun. Hey. One of the things that I can tell you for absolute for sure is that we just ticked over our 1 billionth quest completion. I'm totally not kidding. That's a lot of quest completions.
Well, there's a lot of quests you got to grind to get to 50.
There's a lot. Actually, no, you really don't. I'm playing my third alt right now, and I decided to play him as the quest-free guy after the newbie area. He did just enough quests in the newbie area to get his souls, ground his way out through because he was a warrior just charging around and, you know, destroying things, and has not done a single quest since hitting the mainland, has just been doing dynamic content, dungeons, and events, and I've been having a blast with him. So you don't have to grind quests. Mm. You can totally choose to if you want, but it is in fact possible, and it's actually, I've had a lot of fun with it, just doing dungeons, other content, and getting trade skilled gear.
Can you share any statistics on Guardians versus Defiance?
It still remains relatively even. I actually don't even have the latest greatest in front of me. I know that Chris was looking around. He was asking one of our guys for some stats he could share, and I don't know where that is right now.
Oh,
but yeah, the one that I did know for sure was, like I said, the 1 billionth.
1 billionth quest.
The 1 billionth quest was really cool to me.
How many people have done the endgame raiding content? Mm-hmm. I know that's been one of the big sort of stickling issues in World of Warcraft, from, you know, mm-hmm. vanilla to BC to, yeah. you know, from thing to thing, the amount of people that participate in raids fluctuates significantly. And it was one of these big ideas that, oh, you know, we should got to get everyone raiding. We're making this expensive content and only, a quarter of a percent of other players are actually doing it. I was wondering sort of how you felt about that and how many players in Rift are getting into raids.
Well, it depends what you mean, right? Adding the 10-mans expanded it quite drastically. Now that we're officially supporting them through Slivers, that's helped a whole lot. And then the other thing that we're, you know, that we're using a lot of the raids for is, you know, we've got a new Warfront that's set in Hammernell in 1.5, as well as the Chronicles. So to us, we're not as concerned with how many individuals are playing a specific raid, but it's more, as we make cool content, what are the ways we can make it relevant to the ways different people want to play?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, because, you know, Hammernail is this gorgeous, gorgeous zone, and it is amazing, and it is fun.
And I've never seen it.
Exactly. But you'll be able to, there's two different ways you'll be able to see it without ever being a hardcore raider in 1.5. So I think that doing stuff like that, where we get to use the same backdrop to tell stories, like particularly the Chronicle does that, is important and powerful.
Now, you've got this great-looking for group system that works for 5-man dungeons. Has there ever been thought to expanding that to 10 or 20-man raids?
We've thought about it. Actually, on one of the test server builds, we accidentally created cross-shard raiding for a for a brief patch, and it worked. But it didn't work quite well enough to where we were willing to ship it live, so we had to turn it off. Yeah, it's definitely something that we've been thinking about. It's not on the immediate horizon, but yeah, there's no reason we wouldn't enjoy doing that.
Now, there's actually been, on my server, I play on this role-playing server, Fablight. It's mm-hmm. quite well-known on the forums.
Yep.
But when the looking for group system came out, we were all really excited. When it went cross-shard, there was a lot of backlash. Like, mm-hmm. oh, we don't want to be playing with these dirty PvPers, you know, elite role-players
yeah.
here. Has there ever been an idea of coming back to giving players an option to queue only for their own server as opposed to cross-server?
Yeah, that,
PLFG?
Yeah, you know, anything, any new processing that we put in the back end for group matching with new options and new filters, it's already weirdly expensive to allow people to block people with ignore lists. Being able to, you know, mirror into two different queues or subdivide the population would actually kind of go counter to that. What we've seen in practice is that, you know, again, when we went cross-shard, use of the system went up even more, queue times went down even further, and we didn't really see much negative practical results, because a lot of the people who chose to play with folks on their same server just continued to form groups and chat on their same server.
Yeah.
And then they can go in and use the LFG system to get the rewards for, you know, a little bit of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, because you can queue with a full group of five, and
right.
then you just
yep.
get the bonuses, and you don't have to walk to the dungeon, which is
yep.
nice.
Exactly.
So I'm glad you didn't put in some sort of flag where you have to, you know, queue with random people to
yeah,
get
yeah.
rewards.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was yeah. Nice. It was an intentional decision to let people. Well, look, yeah. If you want to play locally, that's awesome. Play locally. Find your friends in chat and just go.
Rift always catches my attention for taking one step further as far as reacting to players, meeting their needs and what they ask for, and of course putting out content at that unbelievable pace.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I really appreciate hearing that. That's one of the things that we talk about internally too, is that, you know, these days what people traditionally think of as quality isn't really even enough, is you also have to be relevant. I can fix something that you cared about a year ago, but if I fix it a year later, it doesn't matter what the quality of the solution is. You know, a lot of the changes that you're seeing in the game over the last, you know, last few updates as well as this next update, they've all been concerns that have been raised and their reactions to practical matters in the game that have occurred since launch. And so being able to turn around some of them in a month and turn around others in 2 months, I think is pretty unique. And yeah, we're really glad to be able to do it.
One of the things that we also talked about way back 6 months ago when we were comparing, remember we were talking about in-game economies and how EverQuest 2 early on had this interactive economy where you had to work with other crafters, and how Rift, when it launched, had a very isolated crafting system. Recently, you added a new sort of, I guess, an expansion to the crafting system with these high-end epic items that you could craft that required you to gather components from other crafters.
Yep.
But it was also a big money sink because it costs like 10 plat just to make any of these things. Can you give us any feedback on how you went about designing that system and what your goals were with that?
The goals were pretty simple. It was give crafters some more extremely high-end and therefore almost always relevant gear to be able to make at the high-end in a place where they could exchange their services with each other as well as exchanging goods. And the assumption being that if you do it all the way at the high-end, it works out pretty well because you're not creating this interdependence all the way up the chain. I can still progress. I can still become a better crafter. But if I want to make the best of the best crafting gear, well, then now there's suddenly some other interactions that need to take place. And so far, we're treating them as a big success. I mean, the demand is definitely there. The items are definitely getting created and sold at a respectable rate. And it was more about bringing crafters, giving them more relevance into the high-end game of Rift.
Was there also the goal of creating a money sink to extract some platinum from the economy?
Money sink isn't really the way to think about it as far as I'm concerned. It was paying for, it was what final value should these things feel like they deserve? And that is, by extracting money is how things get value. And, I think they are very value appropriate given the rates at which players can get coin. It feels pretty commensurate with what you're getting for your money.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can't make epics like that too cheap or else.
Exactly, yeah.
Then they're even worse than welfare epics.
Right, exactly.
The other interesting thing I noticed with the events, that you always have these sort of social aspects to the events. You have these daily quests that you can do in town for these tokens.
Yep.
I think one or two days ago, you added a new one where you turn into a sea cap and you run around town.
The sea cap races.
It's brilliant. I love it. For months, these events have been kind of annoying. You know, you go out of town, you vaporize 9 corpses. I'm like, yeah, that's really annoying. And now I can do a sea cap race.
Yes.
And it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
Who came up with that idea?
That was one of our event designers. You know, he's been working on these things since the outset. And as people continue to do their jobs longer, they continue to come up with more and more creative stuff.
And one very final issue about what might be coming in the future, something we again touched on briefly, was the idea of mods and add-ons.
Yes.
You know, in the last 6 months, we don't have add-ons actively in the game, but I've read a lot on the forums about plans on adding an add-on system. How has that sort of progressed and how do you feel about it?
So yeah, the add-on system actually hit its alpha on Test Shard maybe even 2 months ago by now, where we turn it on and off on Test Shard as we do more testing rounds on it. If all goes well, it will go to what we're calling live beta, where it will be available on the live servers as of 1.5. We're starting with a system that is a pretty robust set of letting you do the basics, and we will be continuously enhancing it from there.
Do you know if there will be any sort of official try-on add-ons, or will all the add-ons be created by the community?
We have some sample add-ons and some sample libraries that the game has already been shipping with on test. And we went out of our way with our lawyers to make sure that they were licensed properly such that people could use them and abuse them and integrate them into their own stuff freely. The gentleman leading up our add-on development led not just that, but also, you know, the interaction with the lawyers to make sure that not only did we do this technically right, we did this, you know, socially in the smart way too. And, you know, again, kudos to him for, you know, because I agree that is the smart way to do it. And it's, again, great to have people around who working on the team who understand more than just the nuts and bolts of the making games.
Is Tryon looking into any kind of official sort of distribution network for the add-ons? Like, I know with World of Warcraft, you had to go to like Curse Gaming or Ace or whatever. You couldn't just download them through Blizzard or even through the when you're playing in the game. Whereas, an example in Civ 5, when you're logged into the game, you can just open up the mod list and download and install mods directly. I know a lot of hacks were distributed, unfortunately, through the Curse or other mod add-on sites. Like, there would be less official looking add-on sites, and they'd send you
a
hack inside the add-on.
Yep.
And so I always thought, well, if the main company was hosting this, could it protect them in some way?
Yeah, it's, and that's always a challenge, right? The amount of effort it would take to build that up internally versus the value that is created when good actors in the outside world are able to participate. And we are initially going out the door with, you know, we are supported by Curse. Our add-ons, I believe, are already supported by their launcher. I believe they are. If not, that's something that, you know, we had discussed them rolling out with us at the time we launched. And yeah, but to us, it's, since add-ons themselves are such a hardcore community-driven effort, it seemed smartest for us to initially not try to wall off distribution by being the only official place to do it. So we are going out with the community way also, like I said, primarily because add-ons themselves are such a community effort. So we'll see how that works for the outset.
And hopefully we'll see a lot of interesting add-ons as of 1.5.
I hope so.
Comes out soon, I think.
Yeah. No final date yet. As soon as it passes the tests on PTS, and it's got a couple of more rounds of iterations to go, it looks like, we will have a date.
Excellent. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes in the future, and I'm excited that I don't have to wait too long. You never have to wait too long with Rift. There's always something around the corner.
Cool.
It's not like a 18 to 24 month wait.
Exactly.
which is very fun. I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Thanks a lot, man. You too.
All right. Thanks very much.
Take care.